Tiger Woods is in a bit of trouble, hunkered down in the cold and wind in what appears to be a long, tough battle against Nick O'Hearn.
Thank you and good night, Tiger.
What a way to do it. 3-1.
I've been here before, I've played him before and beaten him before.
Tiger Woods and Nick O'Hearn are headed to sudden death.
Nick O'Hearn has this to win.
Yes! Oh! Nick O'Hearn once again is a Tiger Slayer.
He looks like he's aiming right at it.
Looks good. Oh, this is great.
He's got it! Oh, what a shot! Oh, what a shot!
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Tour Mentality Golf Fan. It's the podcast in which we talk to former world number 16 and 20-year touring professional Nick O'Hearn and learn how he went from battling two-marker and teaching pro at Mount Lawley in West Australia to two-time President's Cup player, Australian PGA winner, and a few other things that you may have deduced from our introduction. And he did it all by harnessing the incredible power of the mind. I'm joined, of course, by the man himself, Nick O'Hearn, who is no doubt cringing at the power of the mind stuff because it sounds like, I don't know, self-help or spiritualism or something like that, because in fact his book Tour Mentality, like Dr. Bob Rotella's, is actually, well, it reads like common sense. And the best bit about his book is that the light bulb moments that Nick experienced on that 20-year journey and that he wrote down and turned into a book will help the 15 marker as much as the touring pro. Hello Nick, how are you, mate? How's that mind of yours going?
I'm doing really well, thanks, Matt. Great to chat some more about all this. I'm looking forward to exploring it even further. Fantastic.
All right, just a quick bit of housework, folks. Please do us a favour and rate our podcast on the iTunes podcast listening app. It helps boost our SEO up the charts or something, I'm not really sure, but we're told it's good. So do that, please, and leave your name and golf club, perhaps, or some way we can contact you, because we'll put you in the draw to win one of 5 copies of Nick's book, Tour Mentality. Also accepting, in fact, always accepting questions for the hashtag Ask Nick section of our podcast. We've got 2 or 3 today. And similarly, if you can send us a question via the Twitters, at Nick O'Hearn or at Journo Matt Cleary with 1 T, use the hashtag Ask Nick or email matt@mattcleary.com. And again, we'll put you in the draw for a book and we'll be announcing winners in the next week. And Nick, mate, you'll even sign them and post them out, won't you?
Of course, absolutely. Sign them, you know, put a few tips in there, you know, maybe the odd golf lesson, who knows.
Right, let's get into it. And we'll travel back in time, golf fans, to West Australia in the mid-90s, and young Nick O'Hearn, there he is, 24 years old and a battling professional player. These days it's like 24, you look at the guys on the tour and your Xander Schauffele's and Jordan Spieth, John Rahm, you know, guys just look cherry ripe as soon as they come on tour as 20-year-olds, if you like. There's a heap of them. Go back to Ricky Fowler, Rory and, of course, Tiger and such. But our Nick, age 24, was out there in Geraldton in Western Australia. And for our overseas listeners, Perth is 4,000 kilometres from Sydney and Geraldton is 4 hours' drive north of that. So he's out there playing the Spalding Park Open and he's carded 82, 86, 88. And we'll get into our man blubbering in the car park shortly. But first question, Nick, was there no mercy rule? Why they let you play 3 rounds, mate? They couldn't have put you out of your misery after the first two?
Yeah, they probably should have at the time, but I really like the consistency. I mean, 3 rounds in the 80s or 3 rounds in the 60s, I mean, it's very steady golf, isn't it? So, yeah, it was a very big learning curve there.
Well, so you finished comfortably last, and there you are in the car park, bereft, and your wife, Alana, who you mentioned quite a bit in the book, and you know, was obviously a real rock for you right throughout your golf career. She's effectively said, buck up, buckaroo, let's do this right. Let's do this effectively. What did she say?
Yeah, we had a good chat in the car park afterwards. I mean, my golf was obviously not in the best space possible. She was obviously a very understanding wife, which was fantastic for a young pro out there who wants to make a living. But I think the main thing that we really discussed that day was trying to formulate a plan going forward. I'd sort of been meandering along with my golf and had no real direction. I was just, you know, practicing away with no purpose or intent. It was just kind of, let's see how good I could get, but I didn't really have that plan in place. So the biggest thing is like we said, right, let's give ourselves 3 years. We need a time frame on this, because without a time frame, there's no real cutoff points as to say or check marks to say how you're going or what your improvement's like. So we put that 3-year plan in place to say, you know, 3 years from this date, if if I haven't made serious inroads, or if I haven't, for instance, got my card on the PGA Tour of Australasia, or I wasn't reasonably successful. I know we had some specific checkpoints, but I can't remember them offhand. But it was more having that sense of plan and purpose. And once we put that in place, we then kind of went back and said, okay, how do we go about making this plan happen? And then that started with surrounding myself with the right people and really putting a strategy in place. And from that moment on, once I had that plan in place, it was a case of, you know, you send it out to the golfing universe, so to speak, and all of a sudden the right people started coming into my life at the right time and things just started clicking.
It sounds like, you had a work ethic already, but you just needed to put it into some sort of, you needed to compartmentalize it and have goals and structure to it. So, I mean, you knew you could work hard and spend a lot of time on the range, but to actually be working to something and have it compartmentalized, that was just a light bulb moment for you.
Exactly. Yeah. If you don't have, that sense of purpose of when you get up every day, okay, what am I going to do today? How am I going to get better today? If you haven't got that in place of what you're actually going to do, it's very hard to, have some sort of direction. And I didn't really have it at that point. So once I made that commitment, you're right, I had the work ethic. I mean, I was up at dawn and, practicing all day or as much as I possibly could around working temp jobs or working in a golf club and even stacking shelves at night in a grocery store. I did whatever I could to improve my game, but I didn't have that purpose or that direction. So, once that started happening, things started falling into place. And as I said, I think that was the point I met Neil Simpson, my coach at Mount Lawley.
Yeah, well, that's straight into the next question. You've come into the orbit of Neil Simpson. He was once of Sydney, moved over to West to Mount Lawley. At your first lesson/coaching session, he's looked at your swing and asked, "You're a pro?" quizzically.
that's the beauty of Neil. He's pretty blunt. he's very old school. He'll tell you what you think. And I was probably hit about 10 or 12 balls. And he kind of said, are you a pro? Because you're not very good by the looks. I said, yeah, I've got a great short game. I can chip and putt really well. I just really need help with my swing. And at that point, Neil had just taken over as the head professional at the Mount Lawley Golf Club. And I really just needed some someone to work the magic for me. And just from that first session onwards, what he spoke about and what he sort of showed me and told me was just exactly what I needed to hear at that point. And we sort of went from there.
What was it? I mean, you knew the golf swing fundamentals. You'd spent 3 years as a trainee. Obviously had a fair bit of ability and, you knew how to get the ball out pretty effectively. But what was a light bulb moment with your swing that flicked off when Neil, suggested X, just, I suppose, a technical thing?
Up until that point, I think I'd been very technical with my swing. I was okay. Thinking about it a lot and I figured, Well, I need to get in this position, I need to do this, I need to do that. And I'd forgotten about, I guess, the best way to describe it and what Neil was very much trying to impart on me was the shape to my golf swing. He said, look, the swing's a moving thing. It's not a stationary, stagnant, thing. So don't worry about positions so much. Let's just move your legs and your hips and your body in a certain way so that the ball is going to actually get in the air and start flying. Because from that first lesson, we spoke a lot about ball flight and getting the ball to carry a certain distance, especially with my long irons. Because at that point, I couldn't even carry a 3-iron about 170 meters. And he said, your goal at the end of this, as we start working along, is to carry your 2, your 3 irons close to 200 meters. Now, along the way, I've maybe got it up somewhere around that distance, but I've never been a long hitter. But it was more about the flight and the penetration. So how do you move your body and your legs? And especially for me, it was my hip action to get the ball moving in the right direction and at the right trajectory. And that's what we really spoke about early, rather than let's get the club in this position or so on. And the great thing with Neil was, obviously I'm a left-handed golfer, so when Neil explains things to me, I said, Neil, just show me, don't tell me, if you know what I mean. I'd rather see it because I'm a very visual person. And when he said, do you want me to show you me your left-handed? And I said, no, I want to see it right-handed because I'm more of a mirror image kind of guy. I'd rather see a right-handed swing and then I can copy it. And Neil just had one of those lovely old-school golf swings that, back in the Kel Nagel, Peter Thompson type actions from back in the day, because he was under Alex Mercer, and Alex was one of the greatest, one of the great ball strikers back in the day. And I just love watching this gentleman, you know, this beautiful flowing golf swing. And I thought, oh, I can just copy that all day long. That's fantastic. So it really gave me a good sense of what I was trying to do rather than be rigid and specific with my movements. So that was kind of the big key early on from there. And then we just sort of went about rebuilding my swing. And, you know, the work ethic was never a problem. I put the hours and the time in, and then I began formulating a plan as to how I should practice every day. And then things just went from strength to strength.
It sounds like, you know, you really have a mindset of, you know, that being supple and loose, you know, even not wristy, but, you know, just to have a real, to feel coordinated, for a swing to feel good, rather than, you know, like Bryson DeChambeau's, who's, you know, if I put my left shoulder there and my right leg tenses at the right time, all that sort of stuff, so... It's a real golf swing in your mind, it seems, like the flow of it, the feel of it, rather than hitting a ball, you're swinging through it and, I don't know, have that sort
exactly,
of...
yeah. And that's, if you watch me swing maybe on TV or in tournaments, you'll notice I'm always kind of moving as I'm over the ball. It's almost like a little bit of a dance. I'm never very stationary over a ball. I've got a bit of a long waggle and I'm kind of always moving. And my theory in this game is with golf, it's such a... the difference between golf and other sports is, you know, in golf, the ball is stationary, whereas other sports, the ball is moving, like football, cricket, baseball, tennis, you name it. So you're reacting to it. And in golf, I almost wanted to feel as I was moving, so I was actually reacting to the ball. And I really tried to build that into my golf swing, so it was free-flowing and there was a lot of rhythm to it. There wasn't much power in my swing because I was never really strong enough and I didn't hit the gym too hard, but it was more a rhythm and timing thing. And that was kind of the way I was brought up as a kid. I wasn't brought up these days to tee it high and just smash it as hard and as far as you possibly can, because the golf clubs didn't allow you to do that with the persimmon heads and the blades. Whereas these days, the massive headed drivers and the big cavity back irons, you can stand up there and hit as hard as you want and the ball's not going to go too far offline. So the game was taught a different way when I was growing up. And in my mid-20s, I was probably at a point where, yeah, I just wanted to get the ball under the control because it still wasn't going straight for me because I didn't really understand my golf swing. So that was the essence to my game, so to speak.
I haven't seen Aaron Baddeley putt for a long while, but he had a lovely routine game, and I use it, well, in my nine-marking career. sometimes I size it up and just get straight over the ball and hit it rather than sitting there pregnantly over, waiting over the ball. And it sounds like you do a similar sort of thing, just, like you said, reacting to the shot rather than sitting there pregnantly with this great big pause and allowing your mind that 2 or 3 seconds to bloody think about it. Does that analogy ring true?
Very true, yeah. Aaron's, you know, phenomenal putter over his career, and he was early on, you know, one of the quickest to pull the trigger. As soon as his eyes came back to the ball after looking at the hole, he just started his stroke. And I think some of the best putters in the world do that. I was actually doing a workshop in Sydney over the weekend and talking to some of the juniors about that exact same thing, where you want to react to the target when you're putting. You know, you see the hole, eyes come back to the ball, just start your stroke straight away. The longer you spend over it, more things can come into your mind, and all of a sudden you lose your feel and your touch. And when you react to the hole or to whatever you're doing around the green especially, your distance control just becomes so much better. It's like throwing a ball at someone. You don't really think about how far you're going to throw it. You just see and react and throw it. So if you can build that into your golf as well, that's a really great tool to have.
Another lesson there for our amateur listeners, and I assume that's most of us, get a lesson. Nick and all touring professionals will back this up. All of them get lessons. All of them have coaches. All of them are constantly working on their game and getting outside expert expertise. And, you know, the PGA of Australia will, you know, there'll be pros listening to this now laughing into their coffees because people, I mean, look, we all want to improve our game, but not many people actually want to go and, you know, do what you've got to do. So, I mean, you'd recommend people got to spend, I mean, people spend money on drivers and equipment and all, you know, all sorts of stuff. What about a lesson? I mean, how important for an amateur is to get, you know, 3 or 4, 6 lessons, and you can see improvement straight away, surely.
Yeah, getting the fundamentals down, you know, it's just so important in this game. It's like any sport, anything you do, you need to have that solid base. You need to know how to grip the club, stand, etc. Now, it's not going to be the same for everyone. Everyone has their own little nuances and signatures, so to speak. So it's not like it's a one-size-fits-all. You just have to adapt it to your game. But if you get the general idea of the fundamentals, I think that's the best way to go, with a few lessons to begin with. Go to your local PGA Pro at your course and then just get out there and play and just say, okay, well, what's my, you know, common shot that I tend to hit? What tendencies do I have? And then maybe go back, tweak that a little bit with your pro, with your teaching pro, and then just keep going from there. And the idea is when you're out in the golf course, you know your golf swing so that you can understand it and maybe fix it on the fly if need be. And if things aren't going well, well, that's kind of what your short game's for as well. You're chipping and putting. So, you know, we can't hit the ball great all the time. I certainly don't. So on those days, that's where you need to, you know, think a little bit better than most other times and work the short game and still score. So, but lessons are definitely a huge part of it. People spend, you know, hundreds of dollars, thousands even on equipment, but spend $100 or $200 down at your local golf course with your pro and I'm sure they'll get you on the right track.
Yeah, probably a couple of good books you could read too.
Possibly, yeah.
Mate, all right, so there you are, age 24. We'll go back to that car park with yourself and Alana. Another person that came into your orbit was Neil McLean of the West Coast Eagles Australian Rules Club. Mate, tell us a bit about your first and subsequent meetings with Neil, because I believe he's the guy that sort of sparked your PSR pre-shot routine that was so fundamental to your success.
So part of the plan that we made, that three-year plan, was surrounding myself with the right people or finding the right people to help me with my game. And obviously I needed help in my golf swing. I needed to work a little bit on my fitness, diet, that sort of thing. But another piece to the puzzle was the mental game. And my wife, Alana, rang our local AFL club at the time, West Coast Eagles, and said, who's your sports psychologist? And they said, Neil McLean. So we booked in an appointment. And I started seeing Neil. And again, I needed that structure, the fundamentals. I talk about the fundamentals in the golf swing. We also need the fundamentals in your mental game as well. So, and I really had none at that point. I didn't really know how to think my way around a golf course in the correct fashion. So from Neil McLean, he sort of gave me some homework, and one of the first things we spoke about was a pre-shot routine. He said, what's your routine? I said, I don't know, I don't really have one. And he said, well, there's your first, you know, assignment. Get out there and figure it out and let's work to it. You know, we can talk about it and how you go about building it. And just through the years, Neil provided me with that framework that I really needed to adapt for myself. I sort of filled in all the missing pieces along the way so that it fit my personality and what I wanted to do out in the golf course. But he was a phenomenal sounding board along the way whenever I found myself in difficult situations. And he just really showed me how to pretty much think my way around a golf course in the correct fashion. And it's funny, you know, you put a white ball in front of most normal human beings and they just turn into lunatics half the time. So having that, having those processes and that framework and that structure in place was just a massive key to getting the mind game going for me. And a lot of the lessons I learned throughout the years from Neil is formed the basis of the book. And as I said, I sort of tweaked it myself as to what worked for me and made a nice career out of it.
Was he a golfer, Neil, or?
Not really at the time, you know, a little bit, but he was more, you know, football. He had helped some other golfers, Stephen Leaney, Greg Chalmers along the way, and a few others that we've sort of sent his way, but just a lovely guy worked out of the University of WA, and just fascinating. I mean, the mental game just covers every sport imaginable, I really think. I mean, it's very much similar principles along the way, and you can kind of adapt it as you go.
American and Asian listeners may not have heard of Australia's great cricketer of the moment, Steve Smith, but picture a baseball player at the plate fidgeting like you can't believe, tugging at his collar, shirt, his pants, scratching about and just looking like a proverbial cat on a hot tin roof. But Steve Smith is just going absolutely gangbusters at the moment and is up there among our best ever batsmen. Just looking at him, Nick, what's he doing in the actual all that prior to the playing of his shot? He's got himself a real, you know, he's fidgets around. I'm not sure if it's the same every time, but why is he doing?
Yeah, it's very similar to watching Rafael Nadal in tennis before he serves. He's going through his routine which makes him feel comfortable. At the end of the day, when you step up and hit a golf shot, you want to be in the best physical and mental state as possible. So how you do that, how all the little idiosyncrasies, as Steve Smith and Nadal do, or on the golf course, you know, guys have their varying routines, but whatever you need to do to get yourself in that state is what you do. And for Steve, it's obviously, you know, very unusual to watch. Same with Rafa. Federer and those kind of guys have a different routine in tennis. You watch the football players, you know, maybe before they kick a goal. What was it, Matthew Lloyd, the old Essendon guy, used to toss the wind up, toss the grass up as though there was wind, and he'd even do it in a dome when there was no wind, but that was part of his routine. So that's really what it's all about. It's a matter of getting yourself in that best possible state, and whatever that takes for yourself, that's exactly what you need to do.
Righto. Look, we've had a few questions come in for our hashtag Ask Nick section. And again, listeners, send me an email, matt@mattcleary.com or hashtag Ask Nick on the Twitters. First one today is from Mick Hodgett. He's a mate of mine from Long Reef Golf Course on the Northern Beaches of Sydney. And he asks, and I sort of like this one, because you mentioned a couple of podcasts ago that Hyatt Coolum Golf Course really suited your eye and you'd won there, and you reckon you could be world number one if you'd played there every week. But I suppose how about courses that don't suit your eye? And for the amateur player who plays the same course each week, Mick asks, you know, how do you sort of get in mind if you've got a bogey hole that doesn't suit your eye, or a hole in which, you know, it's in your head because, you know, you've gone out of bounds a couple of times. Mick mentions our 17th hole, which is a strong par four. The ocean is out of bounds left, or there's moguls right, brings a few undone, and, you know, you could be having a nice round and you come to 17 and things, you know, the wheels fall off. How do you make happy memories out of a so-called bogey hole?
Good question. It's an interesting one because you can sort of tack at it a couple of different ways. I think you can either, perhaps if it's a strong par four, think of it as maybe today I'm going to play it as a par five. So how would I play it as a three-shot hole rather than a two-shot hole? So maybe play a little bit more conservatively off the tee, hitting one of your favourite clubs. It could be a hybrid or a three-wood or even a five-iron down there. You don't actually have to actually take driver off every hole. So you could play it that way and play for bogey, which may help. Or if it's a hole that you're just never really comfortable on, the first thing you have to do is recognize that fact and go, well, okay, this is not my favorite hole here. So let's approach this in the way that I'm going to accept whatever result I get. I know it's a real difficult hole for me. As I've spoken about before in this podcast, I have to ask myself that question. What do I have to do right now? Do I want to think about how hard the hole is, or do I want to focus on exactly what's in front of me right now, this particular tee shot? What's the best chance for me to put this ball in play, and what club should I select to hit that shot? What's my routine? What's my swing feel? Go through your process, commit to it, and if the result's good, great. And if it's not, well, you did everything you possibly could. There's just really no other way around it except to go through your routine and commit to it, I'd say.
Question #2 for hashtag Ask Nick comes from Craig, who's a six marker from the Goldfields Golf Club. I think the Kalgoorlie Pro-Am's played there. You ever played Goldfields GC, mate?
I haven't, no. Never got out there.
I believe it's out in Kalgoorlie, which for listeners is, I think, 6 hours west of Perth, east of Perth, sorry, out in the desert. Anyway, Craig, as I said, plays off six and asks, what advice do you have if some of your regular playing partners are, inverted commas, acting out in frustration after hitting bad shots? For example, throwing clubs, cursing loudly and otherwise being distracting and not courteous when it is someone else's turn to play a shot. What advice do you have to block their behaviour out and stop it from affecting your game?
Oh, geez, I've got a good book they can buy. to block their games out, well, I guess there's two ways to take it. They can either confront the playing partners and say, look, let's stop carrying on because you're affecting myself. But if they're not comfortable doing that, it's a matter of switching off better because obviously they're probably not switching off because they're worrying about what their playing partners are doing. So perhaps walk down the other side of the fairway if that's possible. If they're next to them, if they're in the bush with them, maybe get up there and hit your shot first, and before they hit their particular ball, just start walking down the side of the fairway and get ahead of them. Just get out of their zone, basically. That's possibly the only way to do it, but it's a common thing, and we may have spoken about this in the past as well. Just choose better playing partners at the same time. That may be another way, but it's a pretty tough one. But it all comes down to how you switch on and off between shots in that case.
Yeah,
and maybe try some different little cues there with, okay, I'm going to think about this you know, between the shot, I might think about the cricket score or something like that, or, you know, put some headphones in. That might be another way to do it between shots. Pro tournaments, you're obviously not allowed to do that, but maybe in some amateur events, you could get away with throwing some headphones in and listen to music so you can't hear the playing partners. I'm not sure, but it all comes down to switching off for sure.
On pro tours, all the players seem to be in their own cocoon of concentration, and there's only, you know, very few examples of players carrying on like, you know, complete knobs. Sergio's had his moments in the past, just comes to mind. But have you had a, not asking to name names, but have you had a playing partner carry on like a bit of a dickhead, melting down or what have you, and how did you deal with it?
Oh, several times. I just thought, well, there's one less player I got to beat. So in a way, it never really affected me because I just thought, yeah, you just keep carrying on like an idiot. That's fine because I'm going to do my thing and you're obviously not going to play well if you keep carrying on like that. So it never really affected me in pro tournaments because, as I said, I just feels like there's one less guy I had to beat. I mean, US Opens were a very interesting tournament to play because I always found, because the golf courses and the tournament was so difficult, that players, they wouldn't necessarily give up, but they, you know, get well into their rounds and they just know that because they weren't playing great and their score was getting away from them, there was almost no road back because you couldn't make birdies out there. So they were almost defeated halfway around and you're like, well, yep, I'm just going to keep grinding. I'm going to keep my head down and play the best possible round that I can. And the idea out in the golf course is to shoot the lowest possible score every day that you go out there. And some days 82 is a good score. Another day 75 is a bad score. So it just depends on conditions and what's in front of you. So I wouldn't even bother about your playing partners. The beautiful part about it is it's an individual sport, not a team event.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's plenty of good bogeys, aren't there? Sometimes, you know, and for the 9 marker, sometimes 6 or 1 in a big southerly bust around a bad score, or, you know, 4 or 3 can be a miracle. mate, Craig from the Goldfields ads. Now, I didn't find this in Tour Mentality. There wasn't a chapter dealing with dickheads. And it's probably one more for etiquette and diplomacy, and you could probably ask your board or the captain or someone. Email Tom Watson, I don't know. But Craig asks, if you do have a regular playing partner, should they be engaged about their behaviour at risk of making it worse, maybe after the round or even away from the club? Again, this is probably not in your book, and, you know, it's one for etiquette and, yeah, social norms or something. What do you reckon? Got any advice for Craig?
Yeah, I think depends on how friendly they are with their playing partner. I'd probably leave it for after the round because, as I said, when you put a white ball in front of people on the golf course, you know, people who are pretty down to earth and have good common sense, that can go out the window. So maybe they're not thinking all that logically out there. So maybe do it when they are thinking a bit more in a sane mind and, you know, discuss it over a drink afterwards, after the round. And if it just gets worse, well, and if it just keeps affecting your game, I think the best thing for Craig may be to have a word with the committee and say, might be time to give this guy a rest for a few months to see if he can think about his actions and how he's affecting the other players.
Question #3 for Ask Nick is from my mate Spartacus of Lancashire, who plays off 7.
Spartacus,
and I'll tell you
nice.
One day why we call him Spartacus, but it's another story. He writes, "Dear Nick, I got up Saturday morning and I decided that in the Saturday medal I would swing easy and just play with no fear. I felt very relaxed and listened to some music on the way to the golf course. Went on the practice putting green for 15 minutes, hit no balls on the range. My front nine went birdie, birdie, par, par, birdie, eagle, par, par, birdie." So he's 6 under off the stick after 9 holes, equivalent of 10 under net, maybe 27 stableford points. So he's smoking. He continues, "On the 10th tee, however, things were very different in my head. I started to think differently and I started to tighten up. Back 9 went bogey, par, bogey, bogey, par, bogey, 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 bogey. I finished 1 over off the stick, 6 under net and won the medal. And if someone had said I would shoot 1 over gross with 6 birdies, I would have taken it, of course. But I was so freaking mad, I can't tell you." So, Nick, you've got the round of your life going. I'm sure you'll just say, just keep doing what you're doing. But, mate, that's easier said than done, obviously, especially when you're absolutely shooting the lights out like our man has there in Lancashire. How do you learn to keep it going? I mean, we see tour players sometimes stringing 6, 7, 8 birdies in a row. How do you maintain hot form like that?
It is a tricky one, but it's, as you said, I mean, keep it going. That's really the obvious answer, but how do you keep it going is the trick. Usually when you have a good score going, then you start thinking about score. And the reason you had a good score going was because you wasn't thinking about score. I mean, I've heard some fascinating discussions of late of what if there is no scorecard? What if you actually just went out to the golf to play and you didn't even have to write down a score? You just played the game. I mean, wouldn't that be interesting to see what you would shoot? And I can guarantee you by the end of the round, you'd have a real sense of where you are score-wise because you kind of know when you're playing well and when you're not playing well. But if you didn't actually have to think about what you shot that day, it'd be fascinating to see. And I think everyone would shoot a lot better than what they normally did because expectations and results, that's where golf becomes a mental game. It really does. And I think in the first part of your question there, he said he'd just go out there, swing easy and play with no fear. Well, that's, you know, the mindset obviously we want to be in. And I know when I, for instance, if I bring it back to putting, when I putt my best, I putt really well when I don't care if I make or if I miss it. All I focus on is just putting a good stroke on it. And if you can approach every single golf shot out on the golf course like that, with that no expectation, no thought about the outcome or result, you're going to play some really good golf because all you're focusing on is the process. And getting into a habit of doing that is the hard part. One of my favorite games that I like to play myself when I'm out on the course is to, if I'm playing nine holes by myself, is to play two ball best ball. Because in that instance, what I'm trying to do is shoot the lowest score possible. For myself, I'm trying to actually break 30. For two ball best ball over nine holes, if I can break 30, shoot 29 or 28, that's a great feeling. And it gives you that aggressive mindset of just attacking every hole. And when you are playing well in your local comp, that's the mindset you want to be in. And if you have practiced it and if you have done that sort of a competition like a two ball worst ball, I think it just sort of frees you up when you are out on the golf course. And if you're playing well, keep the foot down. Just, you know, have no fear, as they say, but you know, there is a trick to it, and it's always just bring it back to each and every shot, focus on the process, the result takes care of itself.
Yeah, look, well, in subsequent podcasts, we'll talk about your training routines and your little games out on the golf course, because that's some really interesting stuff, and there's that word practice again, fans. There's that takeaway.
Exactly.
Mate, what's the longest string of birdies you've had in a pro tourney?
Ooh, I remember playing in the States one year. I played, there's a tournament in Greyhawk, which is in Arizona. I actually played with Ricky Fowler, I think. Might have been his first pro tournament. I had a very bizarre nine holes. I played the front nine in level par, nine pars, and then I birdied the next six, and then I made a bogey, and I birdied the last two. So I actually played nine holes without a par. I had eight birdies and a bogey, and the bogey was still a one putt because I hit it in the water, so I had 9 1 putts. But I think six in a row is my longest, yeah. So it's not too bad. Didn't James Nitties? He did like 9 or 10 in a row the other day or something. I think there was a record set quite a while back. I don't know. Wow. Fascinating. But when you get on that hot streak, it's a great place to be in, obviously.
Yeah, what a buzz. We've mentioned in previous weeks the mental games. Well, yeah, of pro players that you've played with and against. What about Ricky? You just mentioned there. He seems, you know, sort of California cool, if you like. Again, just walking around, just seems like a very relaxed sort of bloke. And, you know, they talk about the eyes being the window to the soul, if you like. Rick doesn't betray anything and just seems to be having a good time. Could be wrong.
Yeah, I love the way he plays. A really nice guy. You know, that was the first time I played with him a number of years ago. And I was just impressed by actually the speed that he went around the golf course in. Like, he made up his mind very, very quickly. And then just executed. There was no doubt, no second guessing. He just, sort of saw the shot he wanted and just committed to it, which is really impressive from a young player. A lot of the guys nowadays, they tend to take their time quite a bit at going through the process of thinking about their shot, which is all well and good. That's fine. I don't mind them taking their time there. But once they've made their mind up, the key is just to go with it, commit to it, and get it done. Whereas some of them seem to be over the ball quite a long time. And whether they're second guessing themselves, I don't know. But I think once you've made up your mind, just pull the trigger and go. And you talked about Bads with the putting in that sense is great. And Ricky's really good. I love watching him play like that.
Well, there you go, golf fans. Really nice takeaway for your Saturday round. Just get up and have a go at it. right, that's us for another episode. Golf fans, thank you again for your listenership. And again, please do us a favour and rate us on the iTunes app. and hashtag Ask Nick something on the Twitters, at Nick O'Hearn or at Journo Matt Cleary 1T. Email me, Matt, M-A-T-T, at mattcleary.com, and there's every chance we'll send you a copy of Tour Mentality, which is the great Nico's excellent book. Right, what are you up to for the weekend? Nico, you're playing in the Stableford Cup there at Woodlands?
No, I've got a bit of a quiet weekend. I'm actually heading to Moonar Links, going to head down there on Sunday, and then next week's the Vic PGA, so looking forward to that one.
It's been absolutely a pleasure again. Thanks so much, mate. Have a great weekend, and thanks again for your listenership, all the listeners. Hit them well. Don't worry about stuffing up your shot before or after you've hit it. And that's us. Bye for now, and yes, goodbye.